This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mohsen Hamid, is torn between the culture he grew up in Lahore, Pakistan, and the West. He came to America, studied at Princeton and Harvard, worked in business, then moved to England before September 11th. His first novel, Moth Smoke, was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award. His new novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, is about a Pakistani man who comes to America, graduates from Princeton, and rises in business. But after September 11th, he's treated with suspicion in America and grows more resentful of the country he'd come to feel at home in. The story is set in a cafe in Lahore where his family lives. The novel is a monologue by the main character who is addressing an American stranger who may or may not be a spy. They are suspicious of each other. Here's a short reading from the beginning of The Reluctant Fundamentalist.
"Excuse me, sir, but may I be of assistance? Ah, I see I have alarmed you. Do not be frightened by my beard. I am a lover of America. I noticed that you were looking for something. More than looking, in fact, you seem to be on a mission. And since I am both a native of this city and a speaker of your language, I thought I might offer you my services. How did I know you were American? No, not by the color of your skin. We have a range of complexions in this country, and yours occurs often among the people of our northwest frontier. Nor was it your dress that gave you away. A European tourist could as easily have purchased in Des Moines your suit, with its single vent, and your button-down shirt. True, your hair, short-cropped, and your expansive chest, the chest, I would say, of a man who bench-presses regularly and maxes out well above 225, are typical of a certain type of American. But then again, sportsmen and soldiers of all nationalities tend to look alike. Instead, it was your bearing that allowed me to identify you, and I do not mean that as an insult, for I see your face is hardened, but merely as an observation."
That's Mohsen Hamid reading from his new novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist. Tell us more about the narrator of the story.
The narrator is a young Pakistani man named Chingiz who's come to America to attend Princeton University. And the novel begins with him meeting an American man in Pakistan many years later. Chingiz is from a wealthy, formerly wealthy family in Pakistan, which has come upon hard times. They've run out of money, and he's on a scholarship at Princeton. And his story is one of the immigrant from a upper class but poor background, which is a strange combination, making his way in the United States.
The title of your book is The Reluctant Fundamentalist. In what way does he become a reluctant fundamentalist?
He becomes a reluctant fundamentalist in a number of different ways. He's not actually religious. And the novel plays with the notion that someone like him, a Muslim man in Pakistan who has a beard and comes up to an American, would be thought of as a fundamentalist. And in fact, during the course of his time in America, people begin to wonder if he has become one. So he's reluctantly a fundamentalist in being perceived as a religious extremist, which he isn't. But he's also a reluctant fundamentalist because his job, he works for a large financial company that values other companies. And his job is to value companies on the basis of their economic fundamentals. And he goes around the world doing this and begins to wonder whether this is something he wants to be doing with his life, whether it's something he believes is morally right. And so he's a reluctant fundamentalist in that he becomes reluctant at doing that job as well.
Now, you completed the first draft of this novel before September 11th. How did the story that you wanted to tell change after September 11th?
It's interesting because the first draft was the story of a Pakistani man living in New York, wondering whether he should go back to Pakistan and considering whether working in the corporate world was something morally and personally he felt like he should be doing. And in many ways, the novel is still that idea and still that basic story. What's changed, of course, is that the world has changed since then, and it's much more loaded. There's much more fear between Pakistan and America, between the Muslim world and the West. And the novel reflects and plays on that fear.
Your novel is written from one voice, the narrator's voice, and he's a Pakistani man who's, you know, moved to New York to go to Princeton and now works in a consulting company that values businesses. It figures out how much a business is worth. But when he's in Pakistan meeting with this person in a cafe, this person who he presumes is American, we only see this person through your narrator's eyes. And we don't know what to make of this other person. We don't know who he is, whether he means well or not, whether he's a spy or not. Why did you want to structure it that way?
Well, the novel is structured the way it is, with a Pakistani man speaking to an American who doesn't speak back. In part because in the world today, in the media of the world today, we see a great deal of one side of a conversation and much less of the other. So in this case, by reversing that, by having the American be relatively silent and the Pakistani speak much more, I was trying to play with that notion. But also, the two of them, although you only hear one side of the conversation, they do have a conversation. And in that conversation, the Pakistani is wondering, is this American a regular American? Is he a CIA agent here to kill me or abduct me? And the American seems to be wondering, is this Pakistani just a bearded guy who happens to be quite friendly and nice, or is he a terrorist who's here to get me? And that sense of mutual suspicion, which runs through the novel, for me, is a metaphor for the mutual suspicion we have in the world. You know, America and the West looks at the Muslim world in Pakistan and wonders exactly this. You know, are you a bunch of normal people? Are you out to get us? And the Muslim world in Pakistan looks back at America and wonders the exact same thing. So the novel tries to capture that sense of suspicion. So although the novel is really just a conversation, it begins to feel more and more like a thriller. I won't say anything about how it ends, but I will say that people have asked me, this Pakistani character, is he you? Is this an autobiography? And I think that's partly to miss the point. The Pakistani character is speaking to an American character. There's a conversation going on. And for me, that conversation is much more what I'm about. I'm somebody who has both a Pakistani and an American identity. And the novel tries to have a conversation between those identities. So it's much more, for myself, a way to understand my world, the Pakistani and the American parts, than it is to just tell my story.
Let me quote what this character thinks when he watches the events of September 11th as he sees it on television from Manila, where he's visiting. He says, "My initial reaction was to be remarkably pleased. My thoughts were not with the victims of the attack. I was caught up in the symbols of it all, the fact that someone had so visibly brought America to her knees." Do you know a lot of people who felt that way?
I do know people who felt that way. And when we think about how it's possible to feel that way about so obviously tragic and horrifying an act, it's possible because we can look at television now and not necessarily feel anything for people who are hurt or killed on television. They don't seem real. We see so much death and destruction on television that we've become desensitized to it. On the other hand, some people, like Cengiz, who feel envious towards and angry with America for a whole history of events that has led them to feel that way, they felt only that anger expressing itself in satisfaction and didn't feel the personal connection with the people who were actually killed.
When your character is visiting his family in Lahore, Pakistan, when he's about to leave, his mother warns him, "Shave your beard." Because she assumes that when he goes back to America, anyone who sees the beard will associate him with fundamentalism and extremism. Would you be worried about having a beard now in England or in the United States?
You know, I sometimes do have a beard, and it's interesting how it changes people's reactions. It's, in my experience, not a great idea to have a beard when you fly in to deal with immigration officers. And sometimes it's not even a good idea to have a beard when you're walking down the street. But by and large, I haven't found it to be too much of a problem, particularly in the UK, which is where I live now. People react differently to people who have beards, and I've done it myself. I remember sitting on the tube in London and riding next to a Pakistani man who had a beard and began to act very strangely on the tube. And I had the exact same reaction that, you know, a non-Pakistani would have. So I think this reaction to a beard is quite deep in all of our cultures.
You know, that story that you just told, you wrote an op-ed about it for one of the British papers. And, you know, it's a great story because you sit down next to this guy. There's an empty seat next to him in rush hour. And you figure, well, the seat's empty because people are, like, profiling him. And he looks Pakistani. But the guy is obviously mentally ill and not taking his medication or not taking enough of it. That becomes clear from the conversation. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like for you to go through all of these different ideas about who he is and what he represents?
Well, I sat down next to this guy, and as you say, the seat next to him was empty, and I thought it was empty because people didn't want to sit next to some Pakistani guy with a beard wearing ethnic dress. And as time passed and we began to speak, I realized that he was very unstable. I then realized he had this bulge underneath his shirt, which might have been a money pouch, but could have been something else as well. And he acted more and more erratically. It was about a year after the 7/7 tube bombings in London. I began to get more and more frightened and to think, you know, maybe this guy really is a terrorist. And I myself was quite surprised at how I was able to go from a reaction of everybody's racially profiling this guy to a reaction which was, I'm doing the exact same thing over the space of just 5 minutes. And I think for me, what that taught me was, it's not that the outside world is one way and I'm something else. I'm just like everybody else.
Except that you're the target, too.
Except that
when
I'm the target.
People are profiling. Yeah. Does it make you feel any different about being profiled? I mean, that doesn't help, does it?
Well, you know, I think as a novelist, part of what you have to do is empathy. When you write a character, you have to imagine what it is to be that character. And sometimes incidents like this, when you find yourself acting the way that people who upset you act, it actually helps you empathize with people. And you realize, I don't appreciate being the one who's always randomly selected for searches, but I can also understand partly why it happens.
In what ways have, like September 11th, the tube bombing in London, where you've lived for the past few years, in what way did those events change your own sense of identity as a Pakistani?
Well, my own sense of identity actually is a bit complicated because I spent a few years of my childhood in America. My father was doing his PhD at Stanford, so I was at Escondido Elementary School for a few years, and then I went back after high school to study in America and live there for another decade. So there's a great deal of Americanness inside me. I think my identity is both Pakistani and American. And in that way, the tube bombing and the September 11th attacks and the war on terror has been personally very difficult for me because as someone who's naturally split between two cultures, the fact that the two cultures are becoming so increasingly hostile to each other makes me much more unsettled within myself. So for example, it's difficult for me now to go to America as often as I would like to see my friends there. But it's also difficult when I got married in Pakistan and some of my American friends said they didn't know if it was safe enough to come. I think for me, feeling the two worlds slip further apart has opened up a divide, I think, inside myself.
My guest is Mohsen Hamid. His new novel is called The Reluctant Fundamentalist. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mohsen Hamid. He's a novelist. His new book is called The Reluctant Fundamentalist. He's from Pakistan, has lived in New York, and now lives in London. The president of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf, his term expires in the fall. You wrote an op-ed about how you voted for him 5 years ago, in spite of the fact that you knew he was a dictator. Why did you vote for him then, and why do you think it's time for him to leave now?
Well, as a liberal Pakistani, I was very frightened about where the country was going in the year 2002. You know, war had just been fought in Afghanistan, which is right next door to Pakistan. We were hearing all sorts of things about Al-Qaeda and sleeper cells and instability. There was tension with India. And in that environment of fear, I thought that Pervez Musharraf was saying the right things. He was talking about liberalizing the country. He was in the process of freeing up the media and television stations. And he was talking about making peace overtures to India. And I supported those things. I think he seemed like a strong leader at a time of great threat. What happened since, though, has led me to become more and more disillusioned. There have been enormous changes for the better in Pakistan. If you turn on Pakistan television now, you'll see that the number one TV talk show is a transvestite. There are six independent music television channels showing, you know, Pakistani music bands. So there's a lot of liberal media out on the air in Pakistan, much more than there used to be. But at the same time, there have been negative changes. And the most important negative change is that the main political parties, who've always gotten close to 90% of the votes in the election and have been the country's strongest protection against Islamic extremists, have been undermined by a system where they can't participate in power, where some of their politicians are bought off and brought into Pervez Musharraf's parliament, and other ones just sit on the sidelines. And I think in this environment, where we no longer face the existential threat of a possible war with India or with the United States, we have made progress economically and have a more liberal media, the time has come for Pakistan to shift back towards a more democratic setup.
In an op-ed piece, you reprinted the referendum that you voted yes to when you voted for President Musharraf, and I thought I'd read that. It's worded so interestingly. For the survival of the local government system, establishment of democracy, continuity of reforms, anti-sectarianism and extremism, and to fulfill the vision of the founder of Pakistan, would you like to elect President General Pervez Musharraf as President of Pakistan for 5 years? Talk about loaded wording.
Absolutely. It was basically saying, you know, if you agree with the direction of the founder of Pakistan and you want the good of the country, you must vote for Pervez Musharraf. But I thought that he could deliver some good for the country, and he has delivered some good. We're talking now about proposals for compromise with India over Kashmir that we never heard before. If you come to Pakistan today, you will see that the economy is growing very fast. The skyline of the big cities is changing. There's an economic boom of sorts going on. So there have been positive things. But now, as he tries to hold on to power, we're seeing all sorts of negative developments. There are recently in Islamabad, a group of women dressed in burqas, which is full face covering, which is quite unusual in Pakistan, have been protesting and acting in defiance of the government. Near the Afghanistan border, there's all sorts of Islamic militants who are acting up. And these things, I think, could be better coped with by a government which actually could claim to have the legitimacy of people, of the mass of Pakistani people supporting it, which Pervez Musharraf can't do.
You live in London now, and as we speak, 15 British sailors are still being held by the Iranians. Is that increasing the level of tension in England between the British and people who look like they are from the Middle East?
Well, I have to say, in London, my sense of the tension between people who are looking, who visibly look British, and people who look like they're from the Middle East or West Asia, is not that high. Even after September 11th bombings and after the tube attacks in London, I remember walking off the Eurostar train from Paris the same day the tube attacks took place, going to meet a friend of mine in a pub, walking in with my carry-on bag, and nobody looking twice at me. So I don't really feel that there's that much suspicion in a way. There obviously is some, and if you act in a strange way, you will be noticed. But I don't get the sense that I'm so highly under suspicion. Oddly enough, in America, I feel a bit more of that. And I think perhaps it's because in America, the media has done more to frighten people than it's done here in the UK.
Like what?
Well, I think about the amount of coverage that we give to the notion of terrorism and how likely it is to threaten our lives. And in America, 3,000 people were tragically killed on September 11th. 3,000 Americans have died in Iraq. So about 6,000 Americans have died in the war on terror. 42,000 Americans die every year in car accidents. Yet when we see our car in the driveway, we don't suddenly feel a wave of fear. And when we see the bearded man on television or on the subway next to us, we do feel that. And that's a skewed perception. We're much more likely to be killed by an automobile accident, by a heart attack, by cholesterol, than by a terrorist. Yet in America in particular, and also throughout the world, we've received so much information suggesting that terrorism is likely to kill us that we have an exaggerated sense of fear.
You know how we were talking earlier about whether you ever wear a beard and how it complicates how people see you? I just, you'd think I would have done this before, but I didn't. I just opened the book jacket and saw your author photo, and there you are with a beard.
Yes.
So it's funny to me that in this novel that talks about how if you are from Pakistan and you have a beard, people might assume you're an extremist. You didn't shave for the author photo, I see.
Well, you know, it's funny because that author photo was taken by, you know, typically an American photographer who was in Pakistan to photograph an essay I'd written for Smithsonian Magazine. And I happened to have a beard at that time. And that's when he took that. And the reason why that's the photo in the book is because it's taken on the exact same street in front of the exact same cafe that the novel is told at. But in Pakistan, too, I'm seen differently when I have a beard. If I walk down certain streets and I'm bearded, even if I'm wearing jeans and a T-shirt, in a way, I do blend in a different fashion than if I don't have a beard. Not that I really encounter hostility one way or the other, But people assume certain things. And that's what we have to bear in mind. It's not just that Americans assume certain things about Muslims and Pakistanis, or Pakistanis assume certain things about Americans. Everybody assumes things. And a beard is quite a powerful symbol, even in a place where many people do have beards.
Well, Mohsen Hamid, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Tay.
Mohsen Hamid's new novel is called The Reluctant Fundamentalist. This is Fresh Air.